Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Welcome, Jim Jarvis here, and along with me I have my co-host Han. Good evening, Han.
Good evening, Jim. How are we doing today?
Doing really good. We have got a very interesting and exciting topic tonight. We've taken a little different approach on tonight's show in that we're going to take a topic that has been talked about in Dental Town for, as Han would said, for quite a few times, and we're going to actually dedicate the whole show to reviewing that specific topic because it is so involved. And that topic is, I want to buy a house and use it as my office. We've heard it so many times over the years in doing this that we have folks come to us and say, I'd like to build this or I'd like to turn this house into my dental office. And I'm going to renovate it or I'm going to add on to it. And I'm going to create my new space because I can get a great deal on this particular property. Well, tonight we're going to go through all the issues, the aspects of what you need to look out for if you're going to try to go down this approach. We're not going to say whether it's the best idea or not the best idea. Obviously, everyone has their own opinion. What's really best is that you have the information to be better informed so that you can make a decision that is actually best for you. So as our show title has always talked about, Straight Talk, that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the straight facts, the issues, and the aspects of what you're going to get yourself into when you try to go down that road of buying a house and turning it into a dental office. We've got tonight eight key topics that are part of this show, and we're going to go through those, and each one of those are going to have issues and items and things to talk about. And they're not in a particular order, and they're definitely not in area of priority. We're not prioritizing one or the other. Now, if you can go down through this list and check off all eight of these items, then maybe you have a viable project, and it's something you'd like to look forward or move forward with. But we would recommend very strongly that you have to make sure you can check off a majority of these eight items before you move down the path of renovating or turning a house into your office. Now, I want to define a house. A residential house is something that is the current zoning on the property may be residential. It is something that someone has, you know, either lived in or would have lived in, and is not a existing commercial building, per se. So that's what we consider a residential or a house kind of construction. So one of the first topic we'll talk about is zoning code issues and use group. Zoning is that little aspect that we have to go through government approval to make sure that that piece of property, wherever it's at, has the necessary zoning to allow you to change the use. Now, you say, what the heck is a use? Well, a use group is another part of the zoning approval process and the building code. The use group is residential. There's R1, 2, 3, and 4. That has to do with single family all the way through multifamily. Those residential units have a certain code requirement and all kinds of rules and regs that they have to satisfy to be able to build that building. Now, dental office is considered a commercial use, and typically that's either a B or a specialized I, having to do with institutional. Typically, it's a B, which stands for business.
Or business use.
Yeah,
that's
business
use. That's what B stands for.
Yeah, B stands for the business use. And so that has a different criteria that you have to follow. So all of a sudden, you're taking an existing, let's say existing building that you want to renovate and turn into a house. And you could be not even adding an addition onto it. You could be saying, I'm going to take this exact house and not change a single thing on the outside of the building, but I'm just going to do everything on the inside. It doesn't matter. You now have to go in and get approval to change that to a commercial zoned use group of at least a B, business use, from a residential. And then you are held to all the requirements that follow under the B. And there's a slew of them. So we're not going to go through each and every aspect of it, but it deals with things like fire ratings and openings and hallway corridor widths, exiting, window sizes, amounts of exits, meaning the doors, how many are there. For example, you know, is it two floors? If you have a two-floor facility, then you're looking at the issue of being able to get up to that second floor, stair width requirements, stair rating requirements, whether the house is sprinkled or whether you're going to be required to sprinkle the house because of fire rating requirements. There's just a slew of issues that have to be addressed. So I guess one of our recommendations would be, Han, that you hire somebody that knows what they're doing, right?
Well, this is one of those things, you know, they say don't try this at home. Okay?
Don't do this yourself.
Yeah, it require you know, individual that has knowledge that deal with zoning and building issues so that they can help you go through, you know, the process. It's worth investing in. Some municipalities are a little bit lenient and easy to work with, and some are just hard-nosed to the book. So, you know, you can be lucky or you can be cursed, but you don't want to do this on your own. Okay?
Right. So point is, hire a professional who can help you through this process and see if it is actually even viable. I guess we would recommend that you hire someone up front to even do a feasibility to see if it is something that even is possible. And because if you can't get some of these things like the zoning altered and the use group changed, you're dead in the water. You can't even move forward. You'll never get a building permit. You'll never get an occupancy permit, and you'll never turn it into a dental office. It will always be a house, and that's it.
Yeah, if you make that, you know, the major blunder of purchasing it before you do all of your due diligence, then what you actually did is you just bought yourself a rental, you know, a residential rental house.
Yeah,
because you can't
doubt,
do anything.
Do not buy before you at least do a feasibility review to make sure that it is even possible. The next topic is the existing floors. So if I were to look at your existing facility, Han and I go in there, we'll look at this thing, and you're going to say, okay, what is the existing floor? And you may ask, why in the world do you care about what the floor is? I don't care about the finish. We don't care about what's on the floor finish-wise. That's easy to change. What we care about is the structural aspect system that they use. What we care about, is it a slab on grade? Is it a crawl space or is it a basement? Because a crawl space and basement allow for easier accessibility to rework the necessary plumbing and electrical that you need for your operatories. Whereas in a slab on grade means you're doing one thing and only one thing. You're getting on a big concrete saw and you're cutting up the slab to be able to run your underground utilities to these operatories, i.e. the chair, and be able to then have that it's no different than what you have to do, of course, in a, let's say you have a rent, a lease space that's in a retail center. There more than likely is going to be a concrete slab there. You're going to have to cut up that concrete slab and put in the underground plumbing and electricity as necessary. It's the exact same thing in a house. The problem is when you do it in a house, a lot of times slab on grade properties have already under slab plumbing that's been put into place. So when you start cut, and no one knows where it's at because they don't create detailed drawings of a house when they do that stuff, they just do it. And nine times out of 10, you're going to find yourself cutting through existing water lines. You're going to be cutting through existing sanitary sewer lines, and you have to deal with that as a rework. So it becomes a headache. If you had your druthers and you're looking at an existing house, definitely lean towards the basement or crawl space, because then you can get underneath that. You could run your under slab or your under floor plumbing and electrical and be able to at least solve that problem relatively easily. I understand.
Jim,
you want to add to that?
Yeah, there's one. Basically, when we look at the floor construction, there's two major objectives that we're trying to confirm. It is, you know, again, Jim had covered one, is the accessibility, how easy it is to put in the infrastructure for your dental equipment. The other has to do with structural requirements. If you have a house, a residential structure is designed with a certain, loading on the floor. When it becomes commercial, that loading requirement jumps. And so that floor system that you have with the floor joists and all that stuff may need to be upgraded. So it's a structural and financial issue. Okay, knowing it would help you to at least put a checklist of what you need to invest in. Okay.
Right.
That's the addition, Jeff.
Exactly. And the reason why that number changes is a lot of times the occupancy load goes up. The occupancy load of a house is so much smaller than the occupancy load of a business like a dental office. Dental offices or occupancy loads are based upon a number of square feet per person, usually in somewhere in a range of 100 square feet per person or
yep.
higher, because you may exceed that 100 square feet per person, because if you do an actual count of the people that are in there, i.e., I've got at least one person in a chair, I have a technician, I have the doctor, I have an assistant or someone that's that came with that person who may be in the lobby or maybe in the room with them at the same time. So all of and then you have someone coming in that's going to fill in the next time slot who's sitting in the lobby. So all of a sudden, that little 100 square feet has a whole lot more than one person in it. And so you may find
yes.
that you're going to have a lot more occupancy in that house than what was originally talked about. And that takes us to the next very important point, and that has to do with parking. Item that we definitely would check off is, does your property have enough room to satisfy the actual parking requirement by the building and zoning folks, but more so, does it have the actual parking required by you, the user? We've talked about that in previous shows. Go back and listen to all those unique aspects about that in the podcast. But in a nutshell, you've got your staff and yourself, so that's a group of folks. And then on top of that, and there's got to be parking for those. And then on top of that, you're going to have at least one parking space per operatory for, let's say, if you're doing what you should be doing, which is making sure all the ops are full, you're going to have a patient and every there. That's a car for every operatory. So if you have six operatories, you've got six cars. Then on top of that, you're going to have someone coming for the next appointment. So that's another six cars. So there's 12 cars just in patients for a six operatory. What's your staff? You got another six, eight?
10?
That's, you know, 10? That's, the, you know, that's 16, 18, 20 parking spaces. Now, most residential properties are small
inside. A driveway with two cars in the garage, two cars on the outside. You have to have the land to accommodate the parking. Otherwise, that piece of land is not going to work for you.
Well, it becomes problematic, and then you run into the issue. Yeah, then you run into the issue is, well, can I get a variance from the city to allow me to have less parking than it's required by their ordinances? Because they have ordinances that says that you have to have so many parking per square foot or so many parking per occupant. And we've already shown that you're going to have a much higher occupant. So they're going to say, well, okay, maybe or maybe not. And you'll say, well, like you can park on the street in this particular location, which we've seen that before. You can park on the street. Okay, you got some street parking. You're going to have some parking on your property. But then it comes down to the problematic issue is, does your clientele feel comfortable with your lack of parking? And is that does that become a bottleneck or a strangle on your practice because the folks coming to your place say, you know, Doc is really, they're really good people and they're really good service, but, you know, I never can find a place to park. And I have to walk, you know, three blocks around the corner to be able to get to them. I'm going to go someplace else. That's an issue. You've got to be prepared to understand that and either deal with it or work with it. Now, we've had folks that have dealt with it, and one way they deal with it is they don't buy one house, they buy two, one right beside each other, and they tear one down, and they turn that into a parking lot. And that's possible, but you have to be prepared to be able to do that and understand that that is a possibility and a requirement. Then it becomes the point of, okay, the one house is for sale, but the one beside it, that person doesn't want to sell. So you either have to go in the other direction and one of the other two or three directions to be able to find somebody who might sell, or you pay an exorbitant price for that property.
Yeah, make them an offer they can't refuse.
Well, you have to. You end up having to make them an offer they can't refuse, but the problem is it means you got to write a big number on that check to be able to get that piece of property, because once they find out that you need to have it, the price goes up. So
parking is one of those things where more is good.
Yeah, you've got to be so careful. Do not go into it thinking that it'll be all right, because it won't be.
I mean, some municipality may allow you to have, or may require a minimum requirement of, let's say, one parking space for every 200 square feet of the building. Okay, that because business use group could include dentist office, a barber shop, a floral, a number of things that in within that category. But those businesses do not require the kind of parking count that a dentist office require. So the minimum from that are required by the city usually would not be enough for a dentist office. So you have to be cognizant of that when you do your due diligence. Make sure that making the analysis of how that home and the property associated with that home can be made into parking that will satisfy your need, or something else that need to be considered, or to provide you with that deficit. All right, so parking is in our opinion is just as important as how many chairs can you fit into a room or into a building.
Exactly. And the other aspect that we've seen creatively trying to find parking spaces, for example, you know, for the dock and for the staff, that you may have to have a parking area that's down the road, around the block, that kind of stuff, and staff and have to physically walk to the new office so that you can leave all of the available square footage on that site for patient parking. So it, you know, it is a big concern. So let's jump into the next aspect, which ties in with the parking, and that is handicap accessibility. Handicap accessibility, we've had bunches of discussions about, but in a nutshell, obviously, is the federal requirement that an individual that is handicapped has to have a clear egress and an approach path from the parking spot to and into the building in one location. It's not required that every opening or every door leading into your building is handicap accessible. Only one has to be handicapped accessible. It's nice to have more than one, but the requirement is you're only required to have one, and that parking space needs to be at the shortest possible distance from that one location. So if you have a front door, you want to place that handicapped parking space or spaces, depending on how many are required by the zoning, which might be more than one, have to be placed as close as possible to that front door. And then you have to have the accessibility to be able to get a person in a wheelchair, in a walker, on crutches, all those things. You have to be able to get to that point without going upstairs or without going up a incline that's more than 1 in 12. So an incline that is basically rises 1 inch over 12 inches. So to go,
that's the maximum, right?
That's the maximum, and it can only go for a certain length at that point. And if it gets too long, there has to be a flat landing, so that the individual can rest, and then continue on. So if you, you know, do the calculation, if you need to go, what is it, height? If you need to go 10 inches in height, that's 12 feet of ramp. That's a long way.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a long way.
Actually, usually when you look at a house, the way the house structure is constructed, you know, it's usually a couple, you know, a couple of blocks off the earth. So each block is 8 inches. So you usually look at, okay, you got minimum 16 inches of rise. Okay, minimum. And right there is, yet, you know, that's 16 feet of ramps. So you're gonna need space on the property to have a ramp to take you to the ADA or the handicap compliant entrance. Okay, so
exactly. So everybody's gone by, you know, you drive by those houses that see that, and you see that big switch back and forth of ramp that was built. And you could say, oh, somebody in a wheelchair lives in that house, and especially in an urban area where, you know, you get one or two or three or even four steps high, for them to be able to get from the ground level to the house level, you're looking at numerous feet of ramps with landings to be able to accomplish that. So, one, do you have the real estate necessary to be able to accomplish it? And two, do you want to see that on your front door? You know, you've got both of those issues to concern that you need to look at. So the best scenario is a house that is on a basement that only has less than one step from the parking area to the front door. So you're kind of whittling away at those check marks that you're running into when you want to, you know, check off to make sure you have each one of these things accomplished, to be able to say, yeah, that house can be turned into a dental office. It extends into the building. Okay, we're just talking about the outside of the building. and then it extends into the building. So, Han, talk about what you run into in that.
Well, once you get into, onto the building, let's say the house may not have a front door that's wide enough, okay? But once you get into the house and you start to do the layout and stuff like that, there's a, if the house have stair, for instance, then you have to make accommodation for putting in ramps into the house. The checklist is, it's almost endless. But it's,
it could be a ramp. It could be an elevator. It could be a chairlift. There's a ton of different ways of solving it, but each one of those have a big dollar sign attached to them.
Yes. Yes. Everything needs to be looked at on a case by case. So when you want to simplify, your life, if you're looking at a house considering a residential structure, just look at, make sure that there is no interior stairs. Okay, there's no change in elevation because it only add cost and it chew away real estate, interior real estate that are typically not available in most homes, dedicated for accessibility. So, to fix those issues, it's always means more money, and we have encountered both residential and commercial buildings that where the interior have to be greatly modified or resolved so that you have a single floor plate to work with. If you don't have the extra funding to dedicate to resolve that issue, then you could be in trouble. Okay,
house criteria goes to a ranch. So basically you're looking at a ranch with a basement with zero elevation change from the front door to the parking lot. Okay. Now, the other aspect about the handicap accessibility within the building is, do you have the ability to create corridors that are wide enough and the ability to be able to have accesses to restrooms that are handicap accessible? And do you have the ability to be able to have access into doors and out of doors and all the requirements that are required for handicap accessibility? That's really adds to the space. So the idea that you might say, well, this house has, three bedrooms, and I'm going to turn each one of those bedrooms into an operatory, and I'm going to put an addition on and put three more operatories on it. Odds are those bedrooms aren't the right size and don't have the right corridor width going to them to be able to even let you do that, let alone without it making some major interior wall changes. So a lot of times you end up gutting the inside of the building, taking out all the walls and reconfiguring things, which is fine, but it adds cost. And then that cost is, are you prepared to, and does it make sense to do that? That's a question that we can't answer. You're going to have to answer that question based on your unique situation. So accessibility is an issue. And it's not just accessibility of your patients. It's accessibility of your staff. Depending on the municipality and where you're at, you may be required to have the ability for staff to be able to access all the spaces within that building. So you can't say that, down in the basement is going to be storage and staff lounge. We've got a project right now over in Illinois that basically says, no, that has to be handicap accessible.
Here's an example that Jim was talking about. Okay, you decide you just can't pass up a deal because the house, it's at a great location, great big yards, and it's just two-story. But it's a two-story, and you want to use it. What Jim is saying is that the law is the code. Let me see. In the last 30 some years since we've been in this trade, I've never seen code become less lenient. Okay, that doesn't happen. It become more restrictive. So if you consider buying a building that has two story, Jim say what the stair have to have a certain width. Yes, it does, because once you change the use group from residential to commercial, that means that every element in that building may have to be updated. That's, you know, that electrical, plumbing, heating, everything, okay, to the current code. But when you look at a two-story building with or without a basement, the code may say, by the way, because it is a dentist's office, everybody that come into the building, whether it's staff or patient, are considered public, and they will require you to install an elevator. And the elevator for a two-story, by the way, the elevator have to be also ADA compliant. You are looking at somewhere between $60,000 to $80,000, roughly. This depends on what all need to be done. Okay, so knowing that, if you consider it, ask the building official if that is something that's required. But again, this is something that you shouldn't go along on doing on your own. Okay,
right.
Get some help.
So that segues into the next topic, which we're talking about. This topic is circulation and flow. And I'm going to let Han talk about the circulation and flow of what you are trying to shoot for and how you want to fit that into an existing building.
I find that often the discussions when it comes to buying a house converting to a dental office, it's almost on the same breath. The individuals say, and I want to spend as little money as possible. I want to keep as much as possible and only change what I need to. Okay? I would encourage you to look at the picture and with a bigger magnifying glass. You look at how you can optimize the space so they'll give you the proper traffic flow, how it can do, you know, how the work zone can be, you know, can be isolated or divided and things like that. You don't want to go in. We would discourage you to go into an existing house, like Jim said, I'll take the first bedroom, the second bedroom, the third bedroom, and the kitchen, and we'll make it into clinical space. Because by the time that you apply all of the code requirements, all the accessibility codes and things like that, you have very little left to work with. So, you know, the worst scenario is you gut everything and then you start new, okay, meaning that you clean the slate and make sure you don't take any columns and stuff like that. That will bring the building down, but you clean out the entire floor plate, and that way allow you to do the things you need to. Because in a residential structure, an existing hallways are usually only 36 inches wide. The minimum for a commercial is 44 inches wide. We typically prefer 4 feet wide or larger. And so right offhand, you're going to need to enlarge your hallway. Doorways in most residential bedrooms and stuff like that, bedrooms are normally not 3 feet wide. So the door need to be enlarged and so on. So by the time that you start to tinker with the inside stuff like that, it costs you so much to keep what doesn't work. Circulation and efficiency is your main objective. Of course, naturally, to make sure that you also have the operatory count that you need. But you know, you look at the big picture, and chase after. Don't try to save a penny and spend a dime. Or spend a dollar. So normally we look at the entire picture, look at the entire floor plate, and say what is the optimal things to do, and then that's the recommendation we do. We go from including looking at all the doors, look at all the windows. If it doesn't give you the proper traffic flow, change it, because you're going to own the building. You don't have to ask permission like you're leasing the space. If you own the building, you can change almost anything and everything. So they give you the absolute best return for your money when it comes to laying out a dentist office for that you're going to live in for 15, 20, 30 years.
Now, I could see a possible scenario, Han, where actually you could take an existing house, for example, and use the existing house, let's say it's a ranch, use it for the non-clinical spaces, and then do an addition to the house if the property was available or if you had to buy the adjacent property, and let that addition be the operatories so that you can create the necessary flow and the necessary spaces and the necessary efficiency so that those operatories are lined up one right after another. You can go to them directly from the non-clinical spaces that might be the existing house itself. So there is a scenario where that might work, but it's a unique kind of scenario where you have to have the property necessary to do that, and you have to have the square footage of the original house to be able to carry your non-clinical spaces, and then can the two be married together and flow in such a way that it works? That's, in my mind, probably one of the only ways to do it well, where you can minimize.
Ironically,
yeah. But good luck finding that piece of property.
Yeah. Ironically, we are looking at there now. There's a discussion on downtown with that specific scenario in place.
Mm-hmm.
Existing house, and you know, adding on, and that addition make absolute sense. To had to be not attached to the building, but to be, you know, connected to the building. Okay, where the integrity of the existing structure, which is historic, can be preserved and used for non-clinical use, and the addition be, you know. Be purely clinical. Okay, so yes, there is. Again, it's every property, every house, every project need to be looked at on a case by case, you know, situation, so it can be so that the best treatment plan can be formulated for that particular project.
Right, but you're not going to do that on a standard quarter acre piece of property that's a residential lot in a urban, you know, area. That's not going to happen.
That is correct.
You don't have enough square footage. You don't have enough square footage of property to be able to accomplish that. Because what do we use? 350 to 400 square foot per op. If you use 350 to 400 square foot per op, at 400 square foot per op times six ops, you're 2,400 square feet.
Yep.
2,400 square feet is about the average size of a house. Now, depending on where you're at in the country, it could be very small or it could be very big, but 2,400 square feet in just operatories. So then you need all the other good stuff necessary to be able to make that happen. So you got to have the right piece of property to make that potentially work with the circulation, with the flow, and you got to be able to be connectable. It has to make sense. You don't want somebody walking through. You don't want all your patients and staff taking everybody through this narrow little corridor that goes by the restrooms and the sterilization to get to the operatory wing.
It's not unique. It would be a disaster. Yeah.
That doesn't work. So. Flow and circulation. Got to check off that item. Well, that goes into the next topic, which is gut and rebuild. Well, what is really involved with, and why would you even have to do that? Well, we've talked about a lot of areas about what would require that you're going to have to tear apart the inside of that building to be able to bring it up to code, to be able to satisfy the building department, to be able to satisfy accessibility codes, all those kind of things. But mostly, you have to basically spend money to get to zero. You get to the point where you can then start building the new facility from that. Well, what does that cost? It all depends. It all depends upon what you're looking at and what you have to tear down. And that has to be brought into the equation from a dollars and cents standpoint, is what does that cost you? What is that gut and rebuild cost necessary to get you to zero so then you could start building your new facility on the inside? A very important cost that a lot of times people don't think about and they're not made aware of. And then all of a sudden, after they made a decision to move forward, they bought the property, and then they're faced with, oh man, we've got to tear all that out. The building official won't let us do that. We have to tear all that out. I thought I was going to keep that fireplace that was over there. Nope, got to go. You know, everything, all those little things that you need to address and at least get a good idea in your due diligence before you make the decision to buy that house or move forward with the purchase, you got to make sure you do that before, because afterwards you own it and you have to start writing checks to be able to make it happen or abandon the project, which is disastrous.
Yeah, it would be. Jim, what would be some of the characteristics that you can think of when you look at a residential structure? Besides a narrow corridor, narrow doors, the first thing I think of is the 8-foot high ceiling.
Yeah, low ceilings. You're going to have low ceilings, if you get larger spaces like a lobby, for example, those you tend to want to have a higher ceiling in because they feel less like a cave. And the same thing with even your operatories. An operatory that is, even if you go with a small operatory, if you have a higher ceiling in your operatory, it feels more comfortable. It feels a little bit more spacious. If you have a low 8-foot ceiling in a small operatory, it's going to feel like a hole or a cave.
Besides that, you also need certain ceiling height to mount ceiling-mounted equipment.
Okay, technically, right. You need those lights to be able to mount, the light, the televisions, everything you need that needs to be able to mount up there. You may not be able to get that on a typical residential. And then it comes to the question: we'll just raise the roof or we'll raise the ceiling.
There you go.
That's not easy because most of the time houses are built with trusses. Trusses have a bottom plate. And that's what bears on the bearing walls at the perimeter. And that's what the drywall on your ceiling is screwed to. It's screwed to the bottom of that truss. So you're not moving that ceiling height up unless you move that truss up. Or you totally rebuild that truss on the inside. You try doing that, that's an expensive proposition. Because then
it can be done.
Anything can be done. You're right, Han. Anything can be done. It's just a matter of how much money you want to throw at it.
That's right. But you have to take all those things into consideration, and have the right people with you up front. All right. Now, I'm not knocking builders and contractor. Again, they are valuable for your team. But most of them are not visionary. They're not problem solvers. They are not designers and architects. So they have a different eye. They see things differently than the architects and the designer. Okay. So once you buy a building because you talk to a contractor and say, yeah, we can do anything, you buy the property and then you start the design process, and your wishes of what you want to have will cost you dearly, because the things that have been told to you need to be modified at a great extent, if all possible. And yes, everything is possible as long as you throw enough money at it. All right, so take all that into consideration and move forward or run.
Exactly. Well, and that segues into the next comment or next item on my list is the residential codes are different than commercial codes. And that difference is, we've alluded to it, but that difference is huge. There are so many nuances and criterias that make changing a house into a commercial structure problematic. Don't get us wrong. It can be done. But you have to know what the differences are, and you have to address every one of those differences. And they're numerous. It could be, okay, because of the square footage and because of the location and because of the adjacency to another building, a commercial building will have a different fire rating requirement on the exterior than a residential building. That means your exterior wall, once that building's classified as a commercial building, may have to be fire rated, which means you may not be able to put openings, windows, or doors on a particular wall because it's too close to the next door neighbor, or it's too close to the property line, or it's too close to an adjacent building of a different code requirement. There's big differences. The other is the size and requirements may mean that you have to sprinkle the inside of your building because of the construction materials that were utilized for the structure. Sprinkling an existing building is, again, problematic. You've got existing walls. You have to work with those, whichever ones stay. And then you have existing floors and ceiling, and all of that has to be dealt with trying to put in a sprinkler system. So you're paying a premium for some of these systems to be able to put them into an existing area. You have to factor that into your decision process. Is it worth it? Does it make financial sense? Is it something that's even doable? And as we're recommending, please try to get a handle on this before you sign on the bottom line and buy that piece of property or buy that house. Next item that is probably one of our biggest bugaboos that we preach and preach and preach and preach is location, location, location. I know it's a coin phrase. Everybody's heard it. Everybody said it, but it's so critical to a vibrant dental office is being in the right location. Go back and listen to our podcast about the property and location and that kind of stuff. But in a nutshell, you want to be where the majority of your client are going to be and see you, because accessibility and visibility is one of your main marketing components. So the bank you want to be adjacent to. You want to be adjacent to the grocery store, to the gas station, to the hospital, to those major facilities where everybody goes to and that you're accessible. So being buried in the middle of a residential development where hardly anybody goes by might be problematic and might make it difficult for you to succeed as a dental practice just because the location's wrong. Now, we've had projects, and we've had a wonderful project that succeeded very well just south of us down in Findlay that happened to be, it wasn't a residence, but it was a commercial building that was the exact perfect location, adjacent to the bank, across from the gas station, adjacent to the major grocery store on the main street that runs over to the hospital. The school was right around the corner. I mean, you couldn't have picked the more perfect location to be in that particular area in that city. There wasn't a dental office in close proximity. It was prime. The problem is, on that particular property, it was a postage stamp of a piece of property, and the existing building was built way back when, back in the 50s, and since the code and the requirements for easements and everything else had changed. So in that particular building, in that particular location, the only thing that our client was able to do was had to renovate. He had to renovate that building. But in essence, when we were all said and done, only one wall one exterior wall of that building, that existing building, stood. Everything else was torn down, including all the interiors, including all the floor systems, and everything was built new to be able to accomplish that particular project. It was costly.
I think
the doctor would say it was a success because it is a very successful project. It is a great location for her. But at the same time, she had to be prepared and was willing and able to be able to move forward with that kind of understanding. This kind of stuff costs money. So you have to determine, is that what you should or shouldn't do? You were saying, Hon?
Now, the scenario is it's unusual, but the topic is similar. Often the question is, can I just simply tear down the building and build a new one? The answer is, of course, yes. Okay? And then the other answer is, should you? In that particular case, the choice, she didn't have much of a choice. If the building is totally razed, meaning that we take down the roof, the wall, everything, remove the building, that automatically trigger a new requirement that the new building have to be compliant with the existing enforceable ordinance and zoning code and all of that, meaning that the setback for the property which will have to be to the current standard. So that postage stamp site will have a postage stamp building that would not meet her business need. So the only option on that project was to qualify the new building construction as a renovation, that we tear down everything except one single wall. Okay. Now I have run into we've run into several projects where that option was also looked at, where the owner had been recommended by builders and contractor, why not just bulldoze the existing building and build new? Well, when you have a postage stamp site and then you have an existing building that sits on zero lot line, that means that the wall sits on the property line and that building just happened to be the perfect size, but it's old. And you tear it down, that means that the wall may have to be moved in 5, 10, or 20 feet on the side property, on each side of the property. Now you have a building much more smaller than the back property, the front property, and all that. By the time you're done, you'll be in trouble. And then parking requirement, all that stuff kicks in. You're buying a piece of land you can't use. You buy a building that you can't use. So the option of tearing it down and building new need to be analyzed and thought out carefully. Okay?
Yeah, definitely, you're right, Hon. Do not use that as a fallback. Do not use that as to short circuit this process that we're talking about and not going through and checking off these items and say, well, I don't need to worry about that, or I don't need to worry about that, because if it comes down to it, I'll just tear it down and build new. You might, as Hon said, you might not be able to build new because the new right-of-ways, the setback requirements may well require that you make a smaller building than what was originally there. So, and especially when you're changing it from a residential to a business or commercial use, the new code requirements change, and that requirement will also dictate how far you can set the building back from the setbacks. There's just a ton of technical things that will dictate whether you can even do that. So don't, please do not use that as a fallback that, well, I'll just tear it down and build new. Now, if you're out in the middle of, a farm field with a old farmhouse that you've bought and, you really like the look of it, that might be something that would, wow, that'd be really cool to turn that into a demo office and it would look so neat and such. But, Dr. Bill has, our partner, Dr. Bill, has had that exact scenario. And he'll tell you to this day right now that they threw so much money at that, trying to bring it up to the necessary requirements to be able to turn it into a viable dental office, that they would have been much better off financially just tearing it down and building new. Now, on that property, they had the room to tear it down and build new because there weren't any other issues around, then they could have done that. And he'll say to this day, we should have tore it down and we should have built new. So just, I guess, be very, very, very careful about moving down the path of saying, hey, I'm going to buy that house because it's cheap, or it is something that I can get my hands on and I want to just quickly turn it into a dental office by doing minimal amount on the inside because you think it's an inexpensive way of getting from point A, which is nowhere, to point B, is where you have a dental office that's working and functioning, because it may not be that inexpensive. Those hidden things that we just talked about all have a cost associated with them. And you could find yourself in a situation, if you don't do your due diligence up front and at least have a professional look at this thing and give you some recommendations so that you can at least understand what you're going to have to do to turn that building into into a new facility, then you'll have an informed decision and to make sure that's potentially the best for you. Juan?
Yeah, we can't stress the importance of we're not saying hire us to help you with this. You can, okay? Is that don't do this on your own unless you had gone through the process a couple of times, okay? Because there's so many things that that can catch you that by surprise, and those surprises could be rude and could be very expensive. And so a residential structure is handled very differently. But if you have to go into an existing building, an existing commercial building would be a better option. Okay, but again, even an existing commercial building have their things that you need to look at, analyze, study, do the feasibility study, do your due diligence to make sure that it's not a money pit that you're going to throw money, good money at bad. Okay, so this is it's not meant to scare you, it's just meant to inform you.
I mean, you can tell that, we're passionate about this stuff, and, we really do enjoy the nitty and the gritty and the nuts and the bolts and looking all of these things and making sure everything works and trying to give the very best possible solution and telling our clients straight what the facts are, what the issues are, and what's able to be done and what's able not to be done. And what's the best solution and not the best solution. But bottom line is it comes down to your decision. Like when we do projects for our clients, we don't make the decisions for them. That's not our place. Our place is to inform, give all the options, and let you make the decisions because it's your place. It's going to be your facility. It's going to be where you're going to live. It's going to be where you're going to practice. It's where your staff is going to practice and hopefully be able to prosper and move forward with that. So we don't have a dog in the race here in the sense to say, no, you shouldn't do this or yes, you shouldn't do that. To us, we want you to do the best and make the best decision based upon your specific needs. Now, we will have an opinion. We always do, don't we, Han?
We do. I got two.
Yeah. Yeah. We always have opinions, and our opinions are based upon our expertise and our education and what we've seen in the past, and we're more than willing to give you that opinion on what might be the best possible solution. But bottom line, it is your decision on what to do. Just be informed, be careful, be very, very open-minded as to what all might be out there. Just like when you buy anything of this kind of size, just because it looks nice and, you know, it'd be a really cool idea to be able to renovate that existing historic house and turn it into a dental office. It might not be the best financial decision. That might not be the best for you to move forward with your dental practice. But it might be, in the sense that, okay, if it fits all these criteria and you can make it work and you're lucky enough to have enough property to be able to park on it, and if you're lucky enough that it has either the ability to add the additions for the operatories or work them into the floor plan so that everything flows nicely, it's possible. Anything's possible. We haven't seen one yet that has worked, but that doesn't mean it can't be done. So please at least integrate what we've talked about. Talk with a professional that understands what you're trying to accomplish and can give you some straight answers as to whether it's practical or not practical, or possible or not possible, or do you have to spend $1 billion and turn it into a money pit that you weren't willing to do. So hopefully
and,
this has been...
Jim, and the professional that you need to talk to doesn't necessarily mean one individual. It could be an architect, including mechanical, electrical, plumbing engineers, and things like that. So it could be a group of people. But again, what is important is that you get your answers or your question answers, so that way you know that your decision is sound and informed. Okay, it's not something that you kind of wing it. Okay, so it's. That's our 2 cents in opinion.
Well, actually, I think it's been more than 2 cents, but that's okay. We like doing this, and again, we hope very much that everyone has at least had an opportunity to learn a few things, and that information now can be put to good use, and we look forward to the opportunity to do this again. We will have a show on the 22nd, the next Tuesday. That we will have another show, another exciting topic, which will yet to be announced. And we will look forward to spending this time going over some very interesting aspect of the dental design world, and look forward to that. Again, thank you for spending your evening and listening to us rant and rave. Right, Han?
That's right. Okay. Again, appreciate you tuning in to listen to us. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.